Welcome to the AKC Podcast, an audio resource for the King's community following the Associateship of King's College programme. The AKC is an inclusive, research-led programme of lectures which explore diverse religious and cultural perspectives. For more information, visit kcl.ac.uk/AKC. Lecture resources and further reading links for this lecture are available on the AKC Keats area.
Pleasure to be part of this series. It seems a really interesting lineup that you've had. I believe I have the honour of being the closing lecture in the series. I'm glad you did manage to get to Buddhism in the end. I hope you'll find something of interest in today's lecture. So today I'm going to talk about Buddhist narrative, particularly about this important genre of Buddhist narrative called the Jatakas, that is to say, stories of the past lives of the Buddha. But it's also a lecture about the power of the imagination to change our reality, about the role of literature in forming us as moral agents. So since we're talking about narrative, I'm going to start with a story, but then I will leave that to settle and come back to it after I've talked a bit more generally about some of the arguments I want to make about narrative literature. So the story. In the past, so we're talking about a past life of the Buddha here, in the past, there was a very generous prince called Vaisantara. He was always keen to give things away, and at first this made him very popular, but eventually it landed him in trouble. What happened was he gave away the state elephant to a rival kingdom, and the citizens were so cross about this, they went to his father and demanded that Vaisantara be exiled. Prior to his exile, Vaisantara was given permission to engage in one final round of gift-giving, and people came from miles around to receive gifts from him. And then Vaisantara, his wife and his two children, left the city to begin a life in the forest. And they left first in a carriage, but soon someone came to ask for the horses, and Vaisantara happily gave them away. Gods then took the form of deer. You can see this in one of the images on the slide. To pull the carriage for Vaisantara and his family, but soon somebody else came along and asked for the carriage, and so Vaisantara gave that away as well. And after that, he and his wife and his two children had to continue on foot, and they began a new life as hermits in the forest. The story then switches to a neighbouring kingdom, where the young wife of an old and ugly man called Jujika gets a lot of flack when she goes out doing her chores from the other women. They tease her a lot, and she demands of her husband that he should get her some slaves so that she wouldn't have to do these chores anymore. She tells Jujika the news of Vaisantara's great gift-giving and sends him off to receive a gift of some slaves from Vaisantara. Jujika is too late for the main gift-giving event, so he follows Vaisantara and the family into the forest. And when he arrives at Vaisantara's hut, Vaisantara's wife, Mundi, is off gathering fruits, and the children are playing nearby. Vaisantara greets him and asks what he wants, and Jujika says, "I'd like your children as slaves." And Vaisantara grants his request. At this point, the tension builds. The children are not very happy about being given away as slaves. They're scared, they run away, they try to hide. Both Vaisantara and the children ask to delay the gift being enacted until Mundi comes home, so at least the children can say goodbye to their mother. But Jujika refuses, thinking that she'll likely cause trouble, as women so often do, and so off he goes, dragging the tearful children with him. When Mundi returns from gathering fruits and roots and can't find the children, we encounter perhaps the most challenging of all the scenes, because Vaisantara refuses to tell her what has happened, and she runs wild with grief and distraction, trying to find the children and imagining the many terrible things that might have happened to them. Eventually, she faints in grief, and only then does Vaisantara revive her and tell her the truth of what he's done. After all this emotion, the story gets much calmer all of a sudden. Mundi turns out to be absolutely fine with the giving away of her children, and she herself is also soon given away in the sort of climactic moment of Vaisantara's generosity. Thankfully, this time, the recipient of the gift is, in fact, the god Indra, or Chakra, in disguise. He returns Mundi to Vaisantara immediately, and this is a turning point in the story where everything gets reversed. All the gifts are returned. So meanwhile, Jujuka loses his way and ends up accidentally in Vaisantara's father's kingdom, where the children are recognized, they're ransomed by the king, and then the king and queen realize that they were wrong to banish Vaisantara, and they go off into the forest to invite Vaisantara and Madi back to rule. Meanwhile, Jujuka takes rather too much enjoyment in his ransom payment and dies of overeating. And because nobody knows who he is or where his relations are, all of his wealth actually returns back to the king, and the nasty young wife never gets her slaves. So there's a happy ending to this story, and there's a pleasingly symmetrical structure of exile and return, each gift restored until we get back to where we began. And it is one of the most well-known and important stories of the Buddhist world. It's illustrated all over the place. It's retold in many different languages, in many different versions. In Theravada Buddhist context, so that is to say the type of Buddhism that is now prevalent in Sri Lanka and mainland Southeast Asia, it is particularly celebrated because it's considered to illustrate the last but one birth of the Buddha. The story is the subject of rituals and festivals, as well as being widely depicted in art. But its popularity doesn't diminish its ethical ambivalence. So on one level, Vaisantara's gift of his children is celebrated as the ultimate example of generosity and non-attachment necessary for a being on the cusp of achieving Buddhahood. But on another level, his gift causes pain to the children and to Madi and to audience members. And many Buddhists and scholars who are Buddhists, have suggested that Vaisantara's actions were wrong, and even that the story is not really Buddhist, because it offends them so deeply on a moral level. So that's the story of Vaisantara, with its moral ambivalence, and I'm just going to leave it with you for a moment while I talk about some more general considerations, and then we'll come back to it later on. So it is, I think, widely recognised that literature has the ability to generate a form of empathy. Reading a novel about someone very different to ourselves in circumstances unrelated to our own allows us to see the world through different eyes. We often generate empathy towards characters in fiction, even if we know they're made up, and even if we don't really like them very much. Literature often explores moral and philosophical questions. That is to say, questions about how to live a good life, what the consequences of our actions are in the world, how we relate to others. And it can give us a broader set of perspectives on the world than our own narrow life experience is able to. It gives us the space to explore challenges without living them ourselves. As the philosopher Martha Nussbaum puts it, and I quote, "Literature is an extension of life not only horizontally, bringing the reader into contact with events or locations or persons or problems he or she has not otherwise met, but also, so to speak, vertically, giving the reader or reader experience that is deeper, sharper, and more precise than much of what takes place in life," close quotation. Now, Nussbaum has argued, in my view, in a very compelling way, that literature is important to morality, that reading literature is good for you in that sense. And although she's writing about the modern novel, much of what she says is applicable to our ancient Indian sources too. And indeed, her arguments draw on another important source of ancient wisdom, the Greeks. Following Aristotle, Nussbaum argues that we need to acknowledge the ethical value of four aspects of literature in particular. Firstly, that it demonstrates what she calls the non-commensurability of things of value. That is to say, literature offers many different things of value and accepts that they're not easily equated to one another. Secondly, narratives prioritize the particular over the general, since they tell of a specific set of characters and circumstances, rather than offering simply abstract principles. And as Nussbaum argues, real ethical judgment requires recognizing this particularity rather than simply working with these abstracts. Thirdly, literature is often emotionally engaging. And emotion, Nussbaum argues, is important for ethical formation. I'll come back to that point in a moment. Fourthly, narratives recognize the impact of uncontrolled events, surprises, contingency, on the ability of people to live their best lives, or on their ability to be moral agents. Importantly, Nussbaum points out that the very decision to write in a narrative form is an ethical decision, since it demonstrates an ethical commitment to at least some of these four values. In other words, literature is about far more than entertainment, or even imparting values or ideas. It is, by its very nature, more complex and rich as a source for moral development. Even more than this, Nussbaum goes so far as to suggest that literature may be an even more important source than philosophical treatises, since it is a genre of writing better able to, and again I quote her, emphasize the world's surprising variety, its complexity and mysteriousness, its flawed and imperfect beauty, close quotation, than dry philosophical prose. I mean no insult there to those studying the philosophical abstract principles, but she's really making a case for including narrative literature as part of our philosophical and moral discussions. Nussbaum's work is certainly thought-provoking, but to what extent are her ideas, formed in relation to the modern Western literary tradition of the novel, cross-referencing ancient Greek drama, actually relevant to the ancient Indian context? I would argue that her observations about the importance of particularity and of emotion are very relevant indeed. And to demonstrate this, we can cross-reference some ancient Indian theories of narrative. Now, ethical systems are generally expressed in terms of abstract rules, and Buddhism is no exception to this, with its many lists of precepts and of skillful and unskillful actions, defined broadly according to whether or not the mental states behind such actions, and actions here include thoughts and words, defined whether or not these mental states are good or bad. But perhaps aided by this emphasis on mental state rather than the deed or the consequences, Buddhist scriptures also acknowledge the context-specific nature of morality. So the elaborate narrative literature that explores past lives of the Buddha and of others helps to illustrate the workings of karma and rebirth in action through concrete individual examples that offer a richer perspective on good and bad than abstract principles alone. As Maria Heim has shown, the great 5th century Buddhist commentator Buddhaghosa viewed narrative as a distinctive method of teaching, one that provides a context in which actions and motivations can be explored and in which one's understanding can therefore be enriched. And as Heim points out, I quote, "It is not, as scholars sometimes assume, that stories provide simple moral instruction for the unlettered or unsophisticated, but rather that they are the location and condition in which general insights reach maturity," close quotation. In other words, they gain value from their attention to particulars, from exploring general truths in relation to real circumstances. Seen this way, stories are not a move from the complex to the simple, as they have often been seen, but rather they are, and again to quote, "the expansion and growth of general teachings in and through the contingent realities of actual circumstances." I'm inclined to think that Buddhaghosa, who's probably the most famous and prolific commentator on Buddhist scriptures, would approve of Nussbaum's argument, and that Nussbaum, if she was aware of him, would be able to draw on Buddhaghosa alongside Aristotle. As for the idea that emotions are important, here we see also a rich contribution from the Indian side. Before I get to that, though, I just want to unpick Nussbaum's position on emotions a little bit more. Philosophers in modern times have tended to be rather dismissive of emotions, seeing them as unreliable and contrary to intellectual inquiry. But Nussbaum argues that many emotions are actually closely linked to rational thoughts and beliefs. Grief at the loss of a loved one is related to a belief that the person was a positive presence in one's life, that one's existence will be impoverished without them. Anger at the betrayal of a friend relies on the belief that one has been deceived or treated unfairly, that one's trust has been breached. And this close relationship between emotion and belief is further evident from the fact that it is possible to change many emotions by changing beliefs, and vice versa. So anger at the betrayal of a friend, for example, can disappear if we discover that the friend, in fact, did not betray us, or that they had some mitigation reasons for acting as they did. Sadness at losing a loved one can be lessened by the belief that they have gone to a better place. I'm sure you can think of many more examples. And indeed, this intertwining of emotion and belief is something that philosophers have taken forward in the years since Nussbaum's work in interesting ways. But what do our ancient Indian philosophers say? Well, some of you may have heard, in fact, perhaps it's been discussed earlier in this series, of the theory of rasa, an Indian theory that categorizes aesthetic experiences according to what we might call emotional affect. According to this idea, literature, plays, dance, and other sorts of art forms are able to generate emotional responses in a sensitive audience member. So there is a comic rasa generating mirth, for example, and a rasa that generates wonder or amazement. So developed rasa theory is not really contemporary with the earliest Buddhist narratives that I'm talking about, but it shows that there's a broader context that these Buddhist narratives are working within, in which emotions are valued as a valuable part of people's experiences. And this appreciation of the value of emotions generated through aesthetic experiences comes out in two examples that I'll give you here. If you've tended to think of Buddhism as being all about generating non-attachment or overcoming emotions like greed or hatred, then you might be rather surprised to hear that emotions can be valuable parts of the Buddhist path. But one of the most positive states in Buddhism is prasada, in Sanskrit, or prasada in Pali, which is often translated as faith because it is generated by an encounter with a spiritually advanced being, particularly a Buddha. However, faith doesn't quite capture it. It has overtones of calmness, clarity, purity, serenity, so its field of reference is a little broader. Its effects are very powerful. Prasada almost always leads immediately to a gift-giving or an act of service towards the awesome being who's been encountered, and this generates great karmic merit, leading to a better rebirth, often instantaneously. Animals and hell beings and hungry ghosts who experience prasada can be immediately reborn in heavenly realms, for example, or even be assured of the future attainment of liberation. So it's a very, very powerful force in this narrative literature. Another important emotional state in early Buddhist thought is samvega, or shock. And again, a single English term can't really easily translate it. Samvega is a form of existential shock, if you like, usually brought on by some experience of the transience of life or the universality of suffering. And it too generally leads to a radical change of direction. For example, the pursuit of ordination into the Buddhist monastic community or the giving up of some bad mode of life. In other words, both prasada and samvega act powerfully as emotional levers towards better behaviors. They are both related to beliefs about the world, but they go beyond a simple intellectual engagement to powerfully change a person's behavior. People, or rather beings, for in this context we're also interested in the moral capabilities of gods, animals, hell beings, and so on, are made moral by emotion. So it would seem that Nussbaum's arguments about how literature helpfully emphasizes particularity and emotion are in tune with Indian Buddhist perspectives too. Her other two qualities are, though, less transferable to a Buddhist theory of literature. Her notion of the incommensurability of the important things is difficult to transfer to religious literature of any kind, since, by its nature, religious literature tends to be working within a particular idea of what is ultimately important. There may still be some openness in narratives, particularly good ones, but some values are simply wrong. Some seemingly important things are simply not important. Similarly, while Buddhist narrative also includes surprises and presents us with characters whose moral formation is challenged by unexpected circumstances, in a karmic worldview, it is hard to view anything as being wholly unexpected. Characters may not understand their own circumstances in relation to forgotten past lives, but the narrator, who's usually the Buddha, does, or else the audience simply takes for granted that there is some sort of poetic justice underpinned by karma. So this part of Nussbaum's framework is also harder to translate to our context. But these challenges to the applicability of Nussbaum's analysis are in part due to the religious context of our sources, but also due to other differences in genre. So remembering that Nussbaum is writing about the modern Western novel, Jataka stories are a whole different genre, and how we understand that genre will condition how we tend to interpret the ethical value of its stories. So with a novel, it's perhaps easier to acknowledge that the story is about a very particular set of circumstances, that there might be multiple ways of understanding the choices of the characters and their ethical value. With other genres, other forms of narrative literature, particularly ancient literature, and particularly religious literature, we might have different expectations. There is a tendency to extrapolate a general moral from such stories, from ancient religious stories, or indeed ancient moral stories, as encapsulated by one of my least favourite phrases, and the moral of the story is. I really despise that. What a simplistic thing to say. So to give an example, we could take the Aesopic fable of the hare and the tortoise, which I expect you all know. A hare challenges a tortoise to a race and then is so confident of winning that she has a nap. And the tortoise carries on diligently and ends up winning the race. So on the surface is the lesson that slow and steady is better than fast and foolish. And this is the majority reading of the story. Such a simple moral means that we know which character is the exemplar. We should all be more like the tortoise, it would seem. And yet, even with this genre, which is quite a straightforwardly didactic genre, such readings are unsatisfactory to human nature. Just to give my own personal perspective, I don't want to be the tortoise. I rather like the joyousness of the hares running, and I've always wished I was better at napping. And she loses a race, so what? It's the taking part that counts, isn't it? That's what they say. It would make a great story also to tell my friends, being beaten in a race by a tortoise. Certainly wouldn't let it happen a second time. Maybe you disagree, but that's kind of my point. There are, by nature, many different interpretations to a single story, and any attempts to close down these interpretations can only have limited effect. Even a story as simple as The Hare and the Tortoise has been subject to a whole range of interpretations and continues to be open to different readings. And amusingly, I found a new one in the corridor of the hotel where I stayed last night. There's a poster that caught my eye from a different reading of the Hare and the Tortoise story, which is all related to how the tortoise won by basically being obstructive on the underground and stopping the hare from being able to catch a train. So, you know, just as a piece of evidence there, there's lots of different readings. Simplistic moral readings work even less well for a genre like the Jatakas, even though they too have many stories about animals and so have tended to often be read as fables. So I'll give you another example, an animal story, the Jataka of the Dung Beetle, which is a personal favourite of mine and the first Jataka I ever read. The story begins with a dung beetle in a recently abandoned campsite who manages to drink some discarded alcohol. Rather tipsy, he climbs up a pile of dung and it squishes underneath him. "I'm so great, the earth cannot bear my weight," he thinks. At that very moment, an elephant, maddened by rut, enters the clearing, sees the pile of dung, and turns to leave again. The dung beetle, thinking the elephant has turned away in fear, challenges him to a duel. In response, the elephant unceremoniously adds to the pile of dung, thereby killing the dung beetle. There's not a clear moral exemplar here. Both animals are out of their right mind. The dung beetle because of drink, the elephant because of lust. The dung beetle dies because of his intoxication, the elephant kills because of his, an action that is likely to have severe karmic repercussions. And yet both perhaps are relatable characters nonetheless. Doubtless many of us have experienced what it is like to have had a little too much to drink and do something stupid as a result. At least I hope I'm not the only person in the room to have been in that situation. Perhaps also we have done some actions that we have later regretted because of being caught up by lust or infatuation. And even if we haven't done these things ourselves, we know people who have. We understand what it would be like to have done them. And despite the lack of exemplary characters here, the particulars of the story can become a general moral message. Avoid intoxication, as it can cause you to do stupid and even dangerous things. But there's still so much more to the story than this. It's about the small wanting to be it's about the small wanting to be mighty, about the mighty being weak in the face of desire, about the damage caused by the mess left behind by irresponsible human campers, and about how everyone, human and animal alike, shares certain necessary yet unsavory bodily processes. So how many moral messages can we find even in this small and simple story? Now, I mentioned earlier that a Jataka is, by definition, a story of a past life of the Buddha. And in many cases, this can guide the moral reading of a Jataka story because often, though not always, the Buddha-to-be acts in exemplary ways. So we might be interested in who the Buddha is in this story. So I'm going to ask you to vote on this, I'm afraid. So have a think about whether you think the Buddha character is the dung beetle or the elephant. So how many people think it's the dung beetle? Just put your hand up. A couple. How many of you think is the elephant? Okay, more. Okay. Sorry, it was a trick question, actually. That's mean of me, isn't it? He's actually neither. He's identified as a tree deity at the very end of the story, as a tree deity who was watching, observing these rather strange behaviours. So this is one example of a Jataka where the Buddha is actually kind of irrelevant to the story. Perhaps more relevant is that he's telling the story, and he, of course, as the audience will know, has completely clear vision that is never clouded by intoxication of any kind. And this is one of the problems of studying the Jataka genre. It's a really diverse genre, and there are many different types of story under this term, from these short animal fables to much longer romances or epic poems, and even many different narrative expressions of the same story, emphasizing different values or ideas. So it's difficult to say anything general about the genre as a whole in terms of how Jataka stories play into the ethical formation of their audiences. But I still think an approach that is sensitive to this sort of context might produce interesting and relevant insights. So back to Visantara. Let's try an evaluation that is attentive to particularity and emotion on the story that I told you at the start of this lecture, which has hopefully had a little time to settle by now. Now, the Visantara Jataka is at the very other end of the spectrum from the dung beetle story when it comes to the Jataka genre. It's a long epic poem with human protagonists, with the Buddha to be clearly occupying some sort of exemplary position, especially within the Pali or the Theravada Buddhist tradition, where Visantara is believed to be the antepenultimate lifetime of the Buddha. In other words, after his lifetime as Visantara, he's reborn in a heaven realm, and then from there he's reborn back in the human realm as the man who becomes the Buddha, the awakened one. As a longer narrative, it has the ability to affect its audience more deeply and in even more complex ways. In particular, the heart of the story, when Visantara gives away his children as slaves and watches them being dragged off, tied up and beaten, crying out for their mother, is pretty emotionally fraught. And with this emotion comes an ethical dilemma. Was Visantara right to do this? All sorts of challenges are immediately obvious, not least the responsibilities of parenthood, his lack of consultation with Madi, the unwillingness of the children themselves, the fact that in our current ethical context, at least, it is not right that he should consider them his property. In a Buddhist ethical framework, we would also note that he causes suffering and seems to lack compassion for his children and his wife. All of these challenges have been made by Buddhists themselves, and debates continue to this day. One of the challenges in accepting that Visantara might be right to do this is that it can't possibly be generalized as a moral code. We can be pretty sure that it's not right for everyone to give away their children. But such a generalization of the moral is, as we have seen, potentially inappropriate for this genre in any case. So let's instead treat the story as an example of literature, where the particularity of the context informs our ethical engagement. Indeed, the particularities of Visantara's circumstances are crucial to any interpretation of the story. Visantara is not an ordinary human being. He is the Buddha to be, pursuing a difficult path to an attainment higher than any of us would likely aspire to. This particular context is important on a number of levels. For a start, his actions are not generalizable. We need not all give away our children unless we too aspire to be a Buddha very, very soon. And secondly, his attainment of Buddhahood actually allows him to repay his children and wife for the pain he caused them, for he teaches them the path to nirvana. So an important thing about the Jataka genre is that very often characters other than the Buddha are also featuring. So in fact, the children and wife in Visantara's lifetime become his wife, his son, and a prominent nun in his final lifetime. So in fact, he actually is able to ordain them all, teach them the path to nirvana, help them to all achieve liberation during his lifetime as the Buddha. So in fact, the gift becomes a form of exchange. Both parties benefit. The children help him achieve Buddhahood, and he helps them follow him to nirvana afterwards. In the long view, being given away is good for them, but that's a very specific context. The Buddha, after all, loves all beings equally. His is a non-particularized love. He seeks to save all beings. Love for one's children is particularized partial love. That doesn't make it bad, but it is, in a Buddhist philosophical or moral framework, an inferior form of love to the Buddha's. Vaisantara must overcome his love for his children in order to achieve the superior form of love for all beings. And this benefits not only his own children, but many thousands more. But this specific context, though relevant for how we experience the story, does not stop us from getting caught up in Vaisantara's dilemma, or from reflecting on our own actions as a result. As is often the case with stories of exemplary figures, we may find a way in through a softer form of the situation. Often cited in analyses of the Vaisantara story is the fact that in many Buddhist cultures, it is meritorious and so morally celebrated to give one's son to the monastery for ordination, for example. Even more diluted comparisons may help us in a modern audience. For example, questions around how to detach from one's children as they grow up and begin their own lives. But the specific context of the story, the difference between particular and universal love, helps us to see even more related issues, many of which resonate with us in the modern world too. For example, consider the following question. How far is it acceptable to go in order to save the life of your child? Who thinks it is morally praiseworthy to sacrifice your own life to save your child? Most people. Who thinks it's okay to sacrifice the life of an innocent bystander? Oh, a couple. Okay, interesting. We might well be able to think of other items of literature and film and so on that explore just this question, actually, portraying a parent in the terrible position of having to choose between letting their child die or killing innocent people in order to save them. And this, of course, would be an act that we might well understand, if not condone. In relation to Vaisantara, we might like to think what the consequences would have been if Vaisantara hadn't given his children away. He wouldn't have become a Buddha. And then countless other beings would not have been released from the suffering of the cycle of rebirth and re-death. Okay, let's try the second question. How far is it acceptable to go in order to give your own child an advantage in life? Is it okay to pay for a better education for your child, for example? Yep, quite a lot of people think that's okay. What about paying for a better diet for your child? Yep, so most people think that's fine. But keeping in mind the limits of planetary resources and their unequal distribution, benefiting one's own child in this way could be seen as giving them an unfair advantage over others. The modern movement of checking your privilege acknowledges just this. Yet few would advocate not seeking advantage for one's own children. A parent who sent all their income to fund a better diet for people in some other part of the world, while malnourishing their own child, is not likely to be praised by others. They'd probably get into trouble with social services, even if their decision meant 10 children well-fed rather than one, for example. So I'm not trying to argue for any particular answer to these questions, but what I'm trying to do is show that evaluating Vaisantara's behaviour becomes more complex when we accept that he has chosen non-particularized love over particularized love. Taken not as a story about a generous prince, but rather as a story about how the Buddha became a Buddha, we have to recognize, in my view at least, that he is absolutely right to give his children away. But what I also think is really important to recognize is that that doesn't mean that we should feel all right about it. The emotion is still telling us something about morality. It's still challenging us to ask about our own actions and behaviours in the world. And we certainly don't feel okay about it. And neither do many Buddhist audiences. And that's understandable. Even Vaisantara doesn't feel okay about it in many versions of the story. So there are many other stories in which the Buddha-to-be is asked for a gift. For example, his eyes, his head, his flesh and blood, his last morsel of food. He always gives unhesitatingly, without any concern, with joy. He gives with joy. And yet, actually, with Vaisantara, when Judika asks for his children, he hesitates. He suggests that maybe Judika would be best taking the children to the king to get a ransom and get some money instead, and then using that money to buy some slaves. He asks Judika to wait for Muddy's return. When the children are taken away, he enters his hut and weeps. In some accounts, he even considers going after Judika and killing him to get the children back. when his parents come to the forest to invite him to return home to the kingdom, his first question is about the children. And when they are finally reunited, he faints on the spot. In other words, this is far from a dispassionate deed, but is a deliberately emotionally fraught one, with all these literary devices used to draw our own emotions in with his. The story challenges us to feel what he feels. Or perhaps we also, or instead, feel what Muddy feels. Or perhaps what the children feel. Perhaps the story taps into a deep-seated fear that we all had as children of being abandoned by our parents. We are able to experience the particularity of this story, but still relate it to bigger questions and experiences. And the emotions that we feel help us in that endeavor. In other words, Nussbaum's emphasis on particularity and emotion is relevant to this story, but in a somewhat different way to how it works with modern novels. The particularity is not a fictional context, but something considered in some way real. And the choices that the main character makes are not the same choices that we need to make, since he is the Buddha-to-be, a whole different category of being to ourselves. And yet, by being drawn into his world, especially through the emotional weight of the story's central events, enables us to see ways in which our own situations and decisions can be enriched or indeed challenged. And this difference in genre is an interesting note on which to close, for Jataka stories are not straightforwardly fiction. They are literature, but they are in many cases considered true in some sense. And yet their value perhaps lies not in their claim to represent things that actually happened, but rather in their ability to affect their audience. And here again we have another area in which we might learn from ancient Indian understandings of literature. For while we might be tempted to draw a clear distinction between what is real and what is imaginary, and place more value on the real, this is not so much the case for ancient India. Literary and religious practices often accept the power of the imagination, the value of the imaginary over and above what appears to be externally real. For the context that we have been discussing, the value of narrative literature and ethical formation, this is not such a radical idea. Although Nussbaum doesn't really talk about imagination as a term, the idea that we gain morally from imagining ourselves into contexts and characters we encounter in literature is key to her approach. And that much is clear for our Indian stories too. We can empathize with a dung beetle. We can feel outraged at Vaisantara's gift, yet also accept its necessity. We can cry with the children as they are led away, even as we rejoice at the Buddha's ability to overcome his attachment to them for our benefit. This throws into question the boundary between emotion and reason, as well as between literature and philosophy. Narratives have value not as simple fables, but as vehicles for working through the particularities of moral judgments within a broader ethical framework. Literature is good for us. So, if nothing else, I hope that this lecture encourages you to go and read some more stories. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the AKC podcast. If you have enjoyed this lecture, please click subscribe in your podcast app to receive future episodes. AKC, at the heart of King's thinking.